Subscribe to our free newsletter. Sign up at the RN homepage.
And hello, good morning. Welcome to Life Matters on ABC RN. Natasha Mitchell joining you this morning. Great to be here with you for the next hour of your day. Week 5 of 6, the Life Matters and ABC Health and Wellbeing Exercise Challenge is racing towards the finish line. Only there might not be a finish line for you. Perhaps you didn't get started, or you might keep it up now that you've had a taste of what it feels like to make a concerted effort to move throughout your week. Loving your tweets and posts about how you're going. Hashtag ABC Get Fit, don't forget. And we're catching up with 4 of our punters today to see how they're going. Some hurdles, as you'll hear. They are only human. And singer-songwriter Melanie Horsnell is joining us in the studio. If you're a single parent with little children wondering whether there are just one day over the horizon, adventures to be had, you might be feeling right now that that will only happen after they leave home. Well, I think you'll enjoy her story. She found her muse in France, and it's a real reminder that adventures can start now, even if you have little children. It's a great story. But as we've heard this morning, more counter-terrorism raids have happened in Melbourne. And Muslim or non-Muslim, if you're a parent, how are you feeling about the disturbing headlines of recent weeks? Headlines about young Muslim Australians taking up the cause of radical jihadist groups like IS, about raids on suburban households housing teens and 20-somethings, about the 18-year-old Victorian man shot after he stabbed counter-terrorism officers last week, and about attacks on mosques and Muslim Australians. As we know, passions can be very powerful when we're in our teens, as can that feeling of disaffection. But what would you do if your teen turned to religious extremism in search of a sense of purpose? What issues do parents need to be talking about at the family dinner table right now when it comes to faith and fanaticism and identity, and indeed about social media and perhaps about racism? Joining us this morning on Life Matters is Ali Khatri. He's a youth worker and spokesperson for the Brisbane Mosque at Holland Park. We also have with us on the line Rafa Chalabi. She's a mother of 3 sons. She works in a business in Western Sydney with her husband Kassem. And we also have with us Silma Ikram. She's a mother of 6. She's a former school principal. She now runs a training school called Diversity Skills, and she's a member of the Australian Muslim Women's Association. To the 3 of you, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Natasha.
Thank you.
It's a very complicated conversation, but a vital one. Silma and Rafa, let me start with you. Perhaps Silma, as a mother of 6, how have you felt about the news that some young Australian boys and men and women raised here, school here, are taking up the jihadist cause? How does that make you feel, that sort of reportage?
Well, obviously, it makes me as a mother and a grandmother of 10, actually, very
wow.
concerned. Very concerned about the excitement that this is obviously generating amongst young people. When you're young and a lot of young boys go through a kind of a rebellious phase, this is where we have a lot of our movements around the world, which begin with young men. It's exciting to think that something new is happening, something which is using emotional language from very historical and very important aspects of state and using the flag and, you know, a caliph and all this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, young people don't often stop to think about how accurate these claims are.
Yes. Rafa, I wonder how you're feeling as a mother of 3 sons.
Of course, it's very concerning as well to me. But you know what I feel is that the problem is being exaggerated by the media. I don't feel that really so many children or so many youths are being radicalized or going off to fight. Like, we have a very, very big community in Sydney, like maybe probably close to 300,000 or 400,000 Muslims. Like, honestly, how many are going overseas to fight or are taking up arms? Also, one other thing, like, it may be true that a lot of people, you know, are going to mosques and, you know, attending religious classes and taking a stricter version of Islam. But does that really make them a terrorist or ready to go and fight. I really don't see that there is a problem, but what's happening is that the media is exaggerating the problem and making it out to be a real issue when it's really not really much. And
yeah.
Those people who are, you know, doing these things, have a history of mental illness, have a history of crime, family issues, being marginalized by society and our community. And it's only like just a few. You can probably count them on the one hand. But our whole community is being ostracized for the actions of a few.
It's a strong point that you're making. What sort of conversations, Rafa, has this prompted around your dinner table?
It has a lot, you know, because my children, are teenagers, and I've got a 23-year-old, and he's very concerned. He tells me, "Mom, how many people are going off to fight? Look at how big our community is. It really is a non-issue. It really is a non-issue, but the media is exaggerating the problem." And I tell them, "No, this is what's happening. I just feel, we're being ostracized as a community for the actions of a few who have mental illnesses and other issues."
How do your boys go on? Yes, Silma.
Yes, with Rafa, I have to agree with her in terms of the media coverage. You saw that Media Watch last night. There has been a lot of over-exaggeration and claims that have been withdrawn about incidents that are related to, apparently, extremism when they're not. So I think the media does have to take some responsibility for inflaming a lot of the issue. I believe there is a significant concern. I think the numbers are very small. We only have to have one major incident here for everybody to be alarmed. And we've already had this very negative backlash on our young people, which has ongoing effects between our communities into the future. So I agree with her, but I think at the same time, we do need to address it. There is an issue.
And that's what we want to talk about partly today too, and have it in a conversation in a calm and clear way, careful way. Ali Kadri, you're a youth worker and a spokesperson for the Brisbane Mosque at Holland Park. What have young people told you about how they're feeling about those headlines, about the stories that we're seeing reported?
Look, before I answer that question, let me put the numbers to what Rafa is saying. There's about 60 people who have traveled overseas and 100 who are supporting it directly or indirectly. So we're looking at 160 people who are possibly radicalized.
Do we know those numbers for sure, though?
Yes, this has been reported in the media, and AFP and ASIO has been saying this for a long time. So, that's 160 people who have either traveled, 60 have traveled, and 100 are actually radicalized. So 160 out of over 500,000 Muslims in Australia is a very small number. So to say that radicalization within Muslims in Australia is widespread is a way overstretch of the real issue.
Mm.
Now, when I talk to young people, their complaints mostly are about, feeling alienated, not feeling part of this country and this society. A lot of these young men grow up in Australia. They are not close to religion as they're growing up. And at certain point of time, when they don't feel part of the country, they look for association with something. And unfortunately, the propaganda run by the terrorist organization attracts them. So I always say to people that, look, when a non-Muslim Australian feels alienated and marginalized, they join gangs, bikie gangs, and so on and so forth. If a young Muslim feels the same way, they're less likely to take up a life of crime as such, but they get closer to the radical propaganda which is spread across the world by the terrorist organizations.
Let's consider social media, because it would appear that some young people, a small minority as you're suggesting, are turning away from mainstream mosque communities and to social media instead for their religious interpretation and to learn about Islam. Does that raise concerns for you?
Yes, it definitely does. I mean, look, a lot of these young men and people unfortunately target and blame mosques for spreading propaganda, and they oppose mosques. But if anything, mosques are the part of the solution, because a lot of these young men don't have knowledge or in-depth knowledge of Islam and Islamic law and Sharia and so on and so forth. So they go and set up a center, listen to YouTube lectures by radicals who themselves have been practicing for a year, 2 years max, and don't come to the mosque, and they suddenly start feeling and seeing Muslims, mainstream Muslims, mosques, imams, and so on and so forth, as weak when it comes to, let's say, standing up for foreign policy or raising their voice when it comes to conflict in Israel-Palestine, when it comes to a Syrian regime killing 200,000 people or Iraqi regime being corrupt. And then they see that, okay, you're not talking about foreign policy, you're not standing up against oppression, you're not talking about that, so we're not going to listen to you about religion, we're going to go and set up a center and listen to somebody who's got very limited religious knowledge but always talks about this in an inflammatory manner.
And certainly that happens on social media too.
Yes.
And Rafa, I think your sons have been quite active at expressing their views on social media.
That's correct. You know, because I do tell them, for example, that Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, would always take the option, the easier option when presented with an issue or an interpretation of the Quran to make life easier for a community. And that's, Islam is a religion of peace. Islam is a religion of harmony. It's not about, you know, of course... That's what makes them really, really mad, that they're being taught at home that we are a bad faith, and then they're being portrayed as the media as violent.
Mm.
That's what's really hard.
So how have they been interacting on social media? Because I gather they try to express their opposition to extremism. With what result in the social media space?
Well, a lot of people, you know, because they're having a valid argument, they're asking us for proof of peaceful sayings in the Quran, and they've been saying that, or trying, for example, some people might misinterpret the verses of the Quran and take it out of context. They've been trying to get the right way and the right interpretation, or to tell people that these, you know, messages are being taken out of context, they're being interpreted in the wrong way, and that's the wrong way to interpret them, and showing them the right way, as much as to their ability, because they are very limited, they are still very young, but with our help, they are doing that.
Mm. Ali, the Grand Mufti of Australia has warned young people not to trust Sheikh Google, or Sheikh YouTube, as he's cleverly described it, and so clearly he recognises this as a real problem. Do you feel that anything can be done about that dialogue that young people are finding on social media?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's a tricky thing to try and intervene in.
Look, what we have tried and done in our part, in Brisbane at least, is we are trying to modernize the way we deliver our sermons and lectures when it comes to Holland Park Mosque. Now, Holland Park Mosque is a 108-year-old mosque, and we made a Facebook page last week. So, you know, we were lagging behind when it came to that space. And a lot of young
landing
men
right in the 21st century now with that Facebook page.
So exactly.
180-year mosque, did you
108,
say?
108.
Yes, I was going to say, So a Facebook page, how do you hope to utilise that, for example?
Look, we're engaging with young people. They're asking us questions. We are posting sermons on the Facebook page. We have a quite modern website now where people go and listen to the sermons. So the young boys who don't want to come to the mosque can listen to the proper version of Islam, the true Islam, which overwhelming majority Muslims follow, in at their home through Facebook, through our website, and ask questions. And we receive so many questions that it gets hard for Imam to answer these questions on social media. Sometimes people are shy to ask a question when you're sitting in front of an Imam and around 100 people. But it's easier to ask a question when you are anonymous on Facebook or on a website.
What sorts of questions?
Look, all sorts of questions, you know, questions about their personal lives, questions about, I had a question a couple of weeks ago, as in why mosques are not, getting politically active and representing the Muslim community to the politicians. Now, you know, our response was that it's not mosques' job to be political, but having said that, there are a lot of Muslims who are actively involved in politics. There are Muslims who talk to politicians about our issues all times. And, these things need to be spread out. And that's what we do now on Facebook page. Mm. We go out, we make statements against extremism. There are some young men who have come up and said, look, we're not condemning extremists enough, for example. And we've come out and shown them that, yes, we have. Grand Mufti has, and imams in the local mosques have.
The problem.
Back to Silma. Ikram, yes. Thanks, Silma.
The community doesn't really have sufficient resources to tackle this problem. I really applaud what Holland Park Mosque is doing, and I wish all of the mosques would do that. But it is very difficult when you're under-resourced. A lot of the mosques operate on donations. Mm. They have very poorly paid imams who do more out of love for the religion than any financial incentive.
So just to put it back to you, though, Silma, then, and I can imagine that many Muslim parents don't want to feed the stigma by feeding these conversations, but as you've pointed out, there are genuine concerns for parents as they see these stories of young Muslim men and women becoming radicalised because of interactions over social media, perhaps being predated upon by extremists who are overseas. So how do families cultivate the space to have this conversation without stigma?
I think there's a very, very important role for fathers to play. Unfortunately, a lot of in the Middle Eastern culture, it's the mothers who raise the children and the fathers that who work. And it doesn't work that well here in Australia because you don't have the extended community to support as much as you do in other cultures. So because a lot of families are more isolated here. I think it's really, really important that fathers really step up to the grade and get actively involved, talk to their sons, take their sons out, spend time with them, listen to them, and talk to them about alternative viewpoints, and also for mothers to really, as much as possible, watch what's happening with their children on the computer. So I think this has been a problem that, fathers have unwittingly fallen into, that they tended to leave a lot of the child-rearing and the close personal relations to, you know, to the mother and to the community. But I think that's something that we can't afford to do now. Fathers really need to be actively involved, listening to their sons and showing them what really Islam is all about. And when I said, when you mentioned about radicalization, I think there's a process that occurs. It's not like because you read social media, you become radicalized. I think there is a feeling of disenfranchisement. There is a feeling of disillusionment with what's happening. And it's a slow process where a lot of young people feel fairly frustrated, particularly because of the media. And also because those who haven't been so successful for various reasons, maybe family breakups and all different kinds of issues, are more susceptible. It doesn't mean to say that they're radicalized since they get on, but it just means that they're more susceptible. We have to care for them.
That's a vital point you're making, Silma, isn't it? Because clearly there is something in this about a search for identity, about a search to feel part of something bigger than themselves.
Yes.
Some kids find gangs, as Ali pointed out.
Or
drugs. Some find both, or they find a more extreme vehicle.
That's right.
Look,
go ahead,
Ali. Yes, look, when I speak to these young men, most of them have got rough backgrounds, like when it comes to, you know, family breakups, when it comes to coming out of countries which are war-torn. And if somebody is a 10-year-old and has seen war, let's say in Afghanistan or Iraq, and then he comes and grows up in Australia, he cannot easily forget that war. He cannot easily forget that killing which he's seen at such a young age. And a lot of times these conversations are still happens in the family about the war because they have extended families in those countries. Now, when they can't find or feel part of this country for any reason, then they get scared of their own safety and security, and they're afraid that the same thing might happen to them here because of what they've seen and what's happening overseas. Now, it's important when it comes to the mosques that we invite these people, and the people, wider community, also takes part in the mosque, because imams, Silma is right, imams are not equipped and they don't get paid enough to do this. So wider community has to donate their time, come to the mosques and talk to these young people, because there's a gap between the leadership and the youth as well, which needs to narrow down.
Ali Khadri is with me this morning. He's a youth worker. He's a spokesperson for Holland Park Mosque in Brisbane. Rafa Chalabi is with me. She's mother of three sons. She works in a family business in Sydney. And Silma Ikram is with us, a parent of six, a workforce trainer, former Islamic school principal. And you're with Life Matters here on ABC. And we're talking about, in a sense, the parents' response to some of the difficult headlines that we've been reading this week about young, a small minority, to reiterate, a very small minority of young Muslim Australians taking up the cause of radical jihadist groups like IS. Rafa, thinking about that point that Silma made about the role of mothers and fathers in the family, I wonder how you think about that and that dialogue that both parents can have with their children.
Yeah, what I do explain to my children, you know, people who have taken the wrong path, you know, have been exposed to negative influences and they're doing the wrong thing. I tell my children always and always, we need to be effective members of society and of our community, that as Australians we have rights and responsibilities, and also that being a good Muslim does not stop you from being a good Australian. We want to be part of Team Australia, but the problem is that we're not welcome. I feel that we're not being welcome to be part of Team Australia, even though we want to. We want to have our rights and we want to have our responsibilities. But unfortunately, you know, I do find, you know, it's becoming a very, very difficult battle. But I keep telling my children to persevere. We are good people. We are doing the right thing. Our religion is the right way, and we have to, keep at it.
Just you mentioned religion, and some will be curious to know if these sorts of events raise genuine concerns for you about the vulnerability of your faith to fanaticism, especially amongst young people, and I'm interested in all your thoughts on that. Rafa?
I'm sorry, I just want to understand. You mean... if my children will be exposed to fanaticism?
Well, whether there is something in the faith that makes young people more vulnerable to appeals from fanaticists. Perhaps I'll pick it up with Ali and then I'll come back to you, Rafa.
Okay. Look, let me answer that question. Islam is a 1400-year-old religion. The modern terrorism, is about 15-year-old phenomenon. So for overwhelming majority of the history, Islam was peaceful. If anything, during the Dark Ages in Europe and during the Crusades, when Christianity was used for radicalization, mm-hmm. Islam went through a period of enlightenment and preserved a lot of knowledge from Romans and Greeks. So there is nothing in Islam as such which attracts people to radicalization. But unfortunately, the geopolitics of the modern world and post-colonial era is something which is influencing these people. If anything, in my personal opinion, Islam is the first victim of all these problems, because these terrorism or these crimes are committed in the name of Islam, which is a very peaceful religion, a 1400-year-old religion, which is misused by few for geopolitical reasons or anger or frustration or whatever you want to call it. So that's why I don't think that there is something in Islam which makes people radicals now.
Silma, how would you respond to those concerns?
Oh, I 100% agree. Absolutely agree. This is, as Ali says, a more of a recent phenomenon. Look, when people feel disaffected, religion, because it's close to the heart, is easy to abuse for political purposes. We have another problem that's happened, and it's part of the colonial issue that Ali raised, that is that we've lost a lot of our very strong scholarship in the community. Islam was part of an administrative structure, and people would study it deeply and long in order to gain positions in administration. That's all gone. We operate under a Western system, which is where there is little encouragement to really engage with the scholarship of Islam.
With what consequence do you think?
Well, it means that we have less real knowledge about what Islam represents, and it is easier for those who are ill-informed to stand on a platform and say Islam is this, when the majority of people haven't really had the training to be able to straight away recognize how wrong they are. So this is a problem that the Muslim world is trying to address.
It's very confusing, isn't it? Because I think all people, Muslim and non-Muslim, would be saying, well, what does Islam represent? And how do you have that conversation with your children?
Look, well, that's why there's a lot more scholarship is happening around the world at the moment, and there is a move internationally to try and reclaim the linguistic Arabic, which gives us the knowledge about Islam, the access to the knowledge of Islam, and to increase the training of Islam. So we have Muslim schools that are growing. But there's also been another slight problem in that a lot of the imams were trained through Saudi Arabia, which had a very narrow interpretation of Islam, a more recent phenomenon. And that also has combined with the lack of deep scholarship to basically mean that we're not as well informed within our own community as we should be. A lot of people try to address that.
Thank you for making that point. Can I just bring it back then to your advice as two parents and a youth worker for parents at this time, particularly Muslim parents, but also non-Muslim parents? Rafa.
One thing I was going to add to that is
that
the Quran is a text, and it's a very old text, and it's open to interpretation. And a lot of people, there is nothing in Islam that makes people radical. It's just that people open to interpret things in certain ways, and it's and they find proof, and they find proof. Like some people like to take a stricter version of Islam because they feel, you know, that the harder they live on earth, the bigger the rewards will be in the afterlife. And that's why they choose to be the harder option. But like I said, it's an text that some people choose the stricter version of interpreting it.
Mm-hmm. So your advice to parents, Ali?
Look, my parents, my advice is simple advice, that get Muslim kids, get your kids to go to the mosques and learn the proper version of Islam, learn the actual only true version of Islam, the historic version of Islam, which gave us mathematics, which gave us algebra, which gave us Arabic numerals. So we need to go back to the fundamentals of Islam and reclaim Islam from the radicals and extremists who are using a very fringe interpretation of Islam to commit crimes. I mean, the terms like jihad have to be reclaimed. Jihad is not about killing people. Jihad is an internal struggle. And I bet you a lot of Muslims, young Muslims, only think of it as a physical form of fighting, but it's not. It's actually claiming, fighting your inner struggles, whether it's against drugs, against any addiction, or against anything bad.
But Sulma, young people are going to rebel, aren't they? And they're going to rebel against the mainstream, as they've always done.
Yes, and I think that's where it's very, very important for parents to engage with their kids. Don't trust them simply because they're playing with their cousins that they're safe. Go and check who they're talking to, listen to them, engage with them, and particularly fathers, spend time with your sons and guide them properly. And that also means that parents need to be a little bit more informed about Islam. It's not just a culture anymore. It is a very vibrant religion with a wonderful message, and we need to reclaim it. All of us need to reclaim the wonderful part of it.
And understand those geopolitics as well. Look, terrific to talk to you, all three of you. I really appreciate your time and your thoughts and intelligence on this issue. Thank you, Sulma Ikram, Rafa Chalabi and Ali Qadri. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Take care. Bye.
Thanks so much. And Sulma Ikram is a former Islamic school principal, parent of six, workforce trainer with an organisation called Diversity School Skills. Rafa Chalabi, mother of three sons, works in a family business in Sydney, Western Sydney. And Ali Qadri, a spokesperson and youth worker at the Holland Park Mosque in Brisbane. Would love your thoughts about this too. It's a vital conversation, but a complicated one, as we've acknowledged. On our Facebook page, go there, or on our website, or our listener feedback line 028 333 1430, and we're on Twitter at RN Life Matters. We'd love to hear from you. And Life Matters is where you are. We are heading around the bend of the exercise challenge next.
Hi, Damien Carrick here. Up next on The Law Report, digital disruptors. Companies like Uber and Airbnb are revolutionising entire industries. They bypass the big players and they connect consumers direct with new providers. But are our legal and regulatory structures keeping pace? Also, Australia's new anti-terror laws. Are they necessary and what freedoms are we exchanging for greater protection? That's coming up on The Law Report here on RN this afternoon at 5:30.
Well, we're into week 5 of 6 in our Life Matters and Health and Wellbeing Online Exercise Challenge. How are you going? Are you managing those 5 hours of moderate activity each week? Lots of people are getting in touch. Use the #ABCGetFit, that hashtag on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram so we can read your updates. A couple of weeks ago, we met some of our participants who are doing the challenge. Let's check in again with them this morning to see if they've been able to follow those exercise programs that we've designed for them. And a reminder that we've also created videos now of those exercises that we suggested to them. Well, the experts did. We're just here to help provide the glue. Ali and Clay Summons live together with their three children in Wollonga in South Australia. Both have long work commutes, you might recall. Welcome, Ali. Welcome, Clay.
Hi, Natasha. Thank you.
Great to have you back. Annalise Stevens is a part-time high school teacher with two very young children and a hubby who does shift work in the mining industry. She joins us from Emerald in Queensland. Good morning.
Hi, Natasha.
Great to have you here.
Thank you. Julie
Gilpin, self-employed massage therapist on the Sunshine Coast in Queensland. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Natasha.
Julie, how are you going? How are you tracking as we kind of approach the end of the exercise challenge? Is it something you want to continue?
Oh, absolutely. I'm really motivated now. I have increased energy. I just feel so much better. So I'm certainly going to keep this up.
How much of a pull on your time has this been?
For me, probably not as bad as the others because I'm self-employed, so I sort of try and fit it in. I can fit it in. You know, I fit it into my schedule without too much of a problem. So it hasn't been. It's motivated me to actually do that 30 to 40 minutes a day, being in the challenge. So I really appreciate being one of the few that's in it. Thank you.
Well, we love having you. What about those knees?
They're feeling much better.
Oh.
They're, they're, they're feeling really good. You know, my legs are so much stronger now, I think. Apart from just the walking that I was doing that I think I was fairly used to, now with doing the other forms, you know, the strength training and more cycling, my knees are feeling great.
Gee. Now, you've pulled a friend in to help you do yoga, I think.
I have, and actually another one, we're starting aqua aerobics tonight. So another friend has joined me on this, and so it's been really good.
That's great. Ali, week 5, you had high expectations. I think life and lurgies have got a little in the way for you.
Yes, yes.
I can hear it. Oh, dear.
We've had it go through the family, and I thought, you know, it might pass quickly, but it hasn't. So that has definitely been a frustration, but I still am motivated, and I also don't want to stop at 6 weeks. I'd like to keep going, indefinitely, really. I feel like it's been a bit of a lifestyle change and just brought you know, it consciously to the way that I feel about my life, and so I'll keep going.
What activity do you think... activity that you've introduced back into your life or into your life has made the most difference or has made you feel the best?
Okay. Well, I have started doing yoga, which I used to do, and I do Drew yoga, and it's lovely. I will keep on with that. But I think on a daily basis it's the walking to, you know, doing the 10,000 step challenge and just having so much awareness about keeping that going. And I've been quite amazed actually that on the one day where I really do a lot of housework that I don't even have to add much more steps in. So housework's definitely, as much as it's not that enjoyable, it really does get you moving.
Yeah, that's a good reminder, isn't it? You've been doing the challenge, the 10,000 steps with work colleagues.
Yes.
How has it changed how you're feeling cognitively at work, I'm curious to know. Does it make a difference or does it just exhaust you?
No, it makes a big difference. Just getting that fresh air and sunshine and walking. And, you know, we even sort of can download a little bit on our walks, and the afternoon seems to go more quickly or... think more clearly in the afternoons rather than getting that that time when you feel that lull of having no energy. So it's definitely made a difference.
Clay, you and Ali together also decided, and this wasn't part of the challenge, you just took it on yourself, to change your diet. How have you done that and what's happened?
Ali's probably done a lot of the work, really, just by limiting what's available in the fridge. So more or less giving up bread, but, you know, without putting myself in jail sort of thing. You know, might lash out a little bit occasionally. But, yeah, that's been probably mainly it, and just focusing all junk food, really. A lot of just really up my fruit intake. So,
fruit.
You know, when I'm hungry, I'll grab a piece of fruit. Probably have, you know, a couple of bananas and an apple for lunch during the day. Big meals, usually just having like steak and eggs for breakfast, actually, but no bread. And then fairly normal meal for dinner.
So I think you particularly are observing a change in your body shape, probably a combination of the two, the exercise and the food. What's happened?
Oh, a subtle change, I suppose.
We like subtle changes, that's what it's about.
Lost a bit of losing a bit of excess. It's ongoing. I mean, it's early days, so but yeah, I'm certainly feeling invigorated. And for me, yeah, I think it's just about, like, once you've got the will, it's really not been that hard for me. I've probably been a little bit slack in that, apparently there's some rigorous weight training and exercise and so on, but all I've, you know, that's been worked out for me, but I must look at that, actually. But
oh, really, so you've been willfully ignoring the exercise program, have you?
No, not willfully. I've just been, you know...
Busy.
...doing a lot of walking, basically. I'm with Ellie on the walking. It's really invigorating, and it's I don't find it hard to find the time, frankly, to fit it in.
How are you fitting it in? Because you do travel a lot in your work as a surveyor. Where are you fitting it in?
So, you know, if I'm in the office, I'll go for a half an hour walk just around the suburbs at lunchtime. And usually, like last night, staying away up in Flinders Ranges, and I just went for a walk, went for a 50-minute vigorous walk before dinner.
Mm. And you wouldn't have done that in the past?
No. Mm. No, that's right. I would have just, you know, sat down in front of the computer and done some more work probably. So, yeah, I have made an effort to find the time there when I'm away, I suppose.
Yeah, good one. Annalise, the Lurgies landed in your house as well. Not you this time.
No.
The
no,
kids.
My 2-year-old.
Oh,
yeah.
So what does that mean in terms of the exercise challenge? Because this is real life getting in the way of this challenge, which is sort of what we wanted to test out too.
Yeah, well, for the past week, I haven't done pretty much any exercise. I've been for a couple of walks, but we're on holidays on the Gold Coast now, school holiday time, and I had great visions of, you know, getting out with the girls, riding bikes, going for walks, going swimming and all that stuff. But my youngest daughter ended up getting pretty sick with some asthma.
Mm.
We had some bad weather on the coast too last week. So I didn't want to be outside with her too much in the cold. And so also I've found it really easy to meet my 300 minutes by going to the gym. But, you know, coming away on holidays, I'm not going to the gym. So I haven't clocked up my minutes for the past week.
Well, that's a good thing in some ways because it's a real life case study of, you know, how holidays and breaks in routine and things like that can get in the way. Last time we spoke to you, you were in absolute agony because of what was called a shred class.
Yes.
At the gym. Did you go back?
No, I haven't gone back to shred, but I am going to. When I go back...
Really?
Yes. When I go back out west, I will go back to shred because... I spoke to a lot of my friends who do those classes and they said, you know, after a few classes, the pain subsides and I just felt proud that I got into it. That's what I've enjoyed about the challenge is it's pushed me out of my comfort zone to try things I wouldn't normally.
Mm.
And it hasn't been so much about exercise for me as making time that's just for me. That's what I love.
How has the family helped with that? Because that's another, we've got an incredible letter from someone who said that they were really determined to have a go at this exercise challenge. They had been doing it. It had been remarkable in terms of carving out time in their lives. But the family had resisted because, you know, just as Mum was about to go for a walk, dinner should have been on the table. And she just had to say, tough, I need to do this.
Yeah, I think I'm lucky in that the gym where I go to has a little creche, so I can take the girls along with me and pop them in there while I do a class.
Perfect.
Or I've taken them in the pram on our walks. So I guess that's sort of involving them with me.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Okay, quick comment from all of you. Julie, the final week, what's the plan?
Oh, just, tonight, new class, the aquarobics.
I like the sound of that.
See how that goes. Yeah, me too. I haven't done one of these for years and years, and I hadn't really thought about it until Cassie talked to me about getting into the pool, and I went, don't really feel like doing laps, but I thought I could look into an aquarobics class, so that starts tonight. More walking, just more of these exercises and just keep it going.
I've lost
a couple of kilos as well too, so I'm feeling pretty good about that too.
That's great. And I'm really loving the story about the knee because that's been my problem too and I'm feeling the same. Hip and knee, getting fixed up with yoga. It's amazing.
I know.
Yeah. Yeah, Ellie, what, final week, Lurgies aside, what are you going to do this week?
Well, I hope to get back into doing more of my dance because that is really what brings the joy and that's something that I've had to let go of with this cold. And I'm also going to head out and buy a medicine ball and some things to have at home for us to work with, resistance bands and things.
Great.
But also I'd love to say to anyone who's following the challenge to talk about it to other people, because you never know what's going to happen. And after going to yoga one Saturday morning, I ran into our local butcher and said, you know, I've just been to yoga and I'm doing the exercise challenge, adding 300 minutes to your week. Yeah. And the next time I saw him, he had joined the gym.
Oh!
So you never know where you're sharing this whole idea is going to take people. So share it.
That's great. Clay, briefly and finally to you.
Well, just taking every opportunity to be active, really. I mean, if there's a choice, walk to the shop, you know, rather than take the car. And, and just integrating it into your life.
Yeah, good point. And Annalise, sorry, briefly to you.
Oh, the weather's come great on the Gold Coast now, so lots of beach walks, I
think. Yeah, it helps. And in that sand with bare feet, it's good work.
It is.
Look, thank you so much for joining us. Lovely to hear from you all and to hear the challenges too, because I think that's definitely part of it. And we look forward to getting your final reports on how it's all gone. Thanks again.
Okay, bye everyone.
Thank you. Julie, Annalise, Ellie, Clayton. Our volunteers, Annalise Stevens, Clay and Ellie Summers and Julie Gilpin. And we have videos of the exercise that we've put together with the support of experts up online now. Just go to the Exercise Challenge page, which you can get to from the Life Matters homepage. It's all there. And some of the exercises simply involve a chair and a pillow. That's it. So you can do it. You don't need special gear. You can do it in your jammies if you want to. And while we're talking about videos, that wonderful interview that we did with Quincy Simon, 6-year-old surfer from the Gold Coast, that video is now up on the RN YouTube channel. It's well worth watching. She had to stand on a kind of box in the studio. Quincy Simon's, that video on the RN YouTube channel. Get to that from the RN homepage. You're on RN. We're getting a little Frenchy next.
Hi, Fran Kelly here. If you're too busy to keep up with the big news of the week, then I'm here to help. On RN Breakfast, we talk to the newsmakers from around Australia.
These people, including the Prime Minister, deliberately mislead.
And around the world.
So there is nobody left in some locations to flee.
Each week, I bring you my favourites.
By taking the work to our site, we can make it accessible to people with disability.
The best of the best from Breakfast. Fran's Top 5, we call it. You can find them every Friday on the RN homepage.
Dans tes yeux, il y a des étoiles. Dans ton cœur, il y a du soleil qui brille comme dans l'eau d'une fontaine. Toujours pareil, jamais le même. Voilà vraiment comment je t'aime. La pénombre de ta chambre et la poussière sur le sol, éclair de lumière par les vitres anciennes, sulfure de bronze et de chair, ton âme accordée à la mienne, pour tout cela aussi je t'aime. Un vieil atelier d'artiste, un mobilier dépareillé, théâtre d'ombre, de velours sombre, aux coupes de terre et bréchées. J'aime tes mains.
Étoile. It means stars in French, and that gorgeous voice belongs to singer-songwriter Melanie Horsnell. It was under a French sky that Melanie wrote that song, a track off her new album. Melanie was nominated for an APRA Award in 2011. She's played alongside Bernard Fanning and Sarah Blasco, Josh Pike, Glenn Hansard and many others, written songs with Wendy Matthews and Catherine Britton for film and for television. I wonder, though, when she first picked up that guitar at age 5, she could ever have imagined that when her little girls were pretty much the same age, she'd be travelling the world with them and a guitar in tow, writing an album in France. And she joins us to tell us a little about all those adventures in the Life Matters studio. Welcome, Melanie.
G'day.
We heard that track. Where did that come from? What inspired that one?
Oh, there's a big story with that one.
Are we ready to tell it? Should we hold off?
Yeah, well,
we'll come back. Let's just come back to that. But what took you to France?
Well, I'd finished my last album, which was in the Cloud Appreciation Society, and I had two little girls, and I was thinking, I hadn't been over on tour overseas for 4 years, and I sort of had to start all my music thing. And so I just decided to, just kick it, really. How are we going to do this? Oh, I don't know. Let's just go. And so I booked a tour in Europe, and I decided to go over there and write a French EP and take my little frogs with me and see what happens. And it was really cool.
I love this. This is what I love most about this, is that, you know, often people kind of, they don't think they can have adventures until their children are old enough. And you just thought, this is the right time for them and me.
Yeah, I just thought it was either going to wait a while or we're just going to have to learn how to do it. And so they sleep next to on the side of the stage in a swag, and they are very good at selling CDs. And, you know, everyone's
talking travels, 3 and 5 here.
Yeah, it was 2 and last Cuties. Year. Yeah, 2 and a half and 4 and a half. And, you know, they're dragging their suitcase along in the train stations by themselves, and you turn around and go, lots of kids are just in prams, and these girls are awesome. How brave are they?
You know? Kind of reminds me of me when I was a kid. But when you were a kid, when you were 5, you picked up that guitar.
Yeah.
What did you think about it as a 5-year-old? I wish I'd picked up a guitar at 5.
I don't know. I really liked sitting with my mum and dad and practicing, because they'd sit down with me and practice. And I realise that as a grown-up, that's probably to do with sitting down with mum and dad. And then later it became about the music, but that first little bit's enjoying that little circle of people playing music together. I mean, they weren't playing the music, they were just teaching it to me, but
yeah. And some people have described the guitar and their relationship to it as like a friend, like a best friend.
Yeah, it's definitely a best friend. Sleeps in the bed beside me.
You had different visions, though, I think, in your teens of where you'd head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought I started working in the supermarket and had this whole idea I was going to be the head of the supermarket, and because I like customers. I like serving, and I like, you know, working in delis and things like that. So,
what pulled you back into music?
Well, I'd written one song when I was in year 10 about a fella, you know, in my music class. And then I hadn't written anything since then, and I entered there was a competition on the Northern Beaches to be featured on this CD, and so I had to enter two songs, and I quickly wrote another song, entered it, and ended up winning a place on this CD on the Northern Beaches, and suddenly thought, oh, I could be a songwriter maybe. Hang on. And so I headed off to England for a year actually after that, just to try and be a songwriter.
So more recently, though, you've headed off to France for this latest album, your 4th album.
Yeah.
Why France?
Because I've been in love with it ever since I was little.
Oh, my producer Tracy says this as well.
Yeah.
She's total francophile.
We've been talking French stuff.
She is obsessed. Why were you obsessed? What pulled you there?
I think, you know, it starts off with little things like Eiffel Towers and the book Madeleine and, you know, all of those lovely stories. And the language is so beautiful to listen to. It just grew on me.
So it's a lyrical language, isn't it? But you went there without really much language at all, and yet here you were making an album in French.
I know, partly. It was a bit mad. Take two kids overseas and try to make a record in French. And I did learn some things, like I hadn't thought about the phrasing, and the phrasing really hit me, because when you write a melody, you actually do emphasise words with the melody, so you can't just make a melody over lyrics without really understanding the placement of the emphasis in the sentence, and I hadn't expected that. I just thought you could make a melody over some lyrics and that would be okay.
And kids just pick up language like that, so they probably did. They're probably little French speakers almost.
Yeah, they like, every time they hear a French person walking past us now, they go, hey, are you speaking French?
How cute.
Bonjour.
Yeah. Comment allez-vous? Yeah. That's about all I know.
Yeah,
but you actually collaborated with some interesting locals, didn't you? And in fact, what's this about being adopted by a region?
Yeah, I kind of got, we kind of winged the whole trip. We did have some gigs booked, but the rest of it was winging it. And in the end, we got adopted by people on the way who would put us up and lend us their cars and things like that. And in the end, we ended up getting adopted by Bourgogne, which was, you know, I just had this feeling about it. And I went there thinking something's going to spark, and it just did. And I got a town of Flavigny picked us up, and a lady called Rauda Jami, who's actually an author, she lets us stay in her house, and I do some gardening, and we all talk at night time.
I love it. And also when you're travelling with kids, parents say they're an entree.
Yes.
They kind of, which is great. They kind of, the people connect with kids wherever you travel.
I love watching people look at them and talk to them. That's my favourite thing, is just the way that they connect with each other. When you're travelling on the train, Gypsy will, meet someone who looks different, and she'll say, "Why do you look like that?" Oh, and they just giggle at each other, these people. And they could get to discover the world because they're small and they can ask questions.
Mm. So, we didn't get the story of the song up the top. Can we get the story of the song up the top?
That was one of my big love songs. It started out with something that I wrote a little bit in Australia, but it was inspired by a friend's artist studio, which has got, it's an old stone building with all this light coming in through dusty glass, and then an old piano, and there's all these sculptures sitting on a desk and red velvet couches. And so it became it went from being a little song about a building to sort of a big love song about a sculptor. And I actually wrote it with Alain River, who's a poet, and I hadn't thought about this, and I thought, is it okay if I write a song about a man with a man? he was like, it's okay, I can imagine it. So it's quite funny when Alain did some translating of my lyrics and added his own bits. The bits he added were very man bits, I might have said something that was a little bit more innocent about the sculptor's hands, and he says, which caress the legs and the breasts of the sculptures of which I am jealous.
Oh,
that's very French. Beautiful.
Yeah. Only the French. We're going to play another track to round us out. But before we do that, I guess there's a message in all this for parents with little kids too, isn't there?
Yeah, it's we think we have to be young and backpack the world, but when you've got the kids, it just opens up a completely different experience, and you can still backpack and you can still do things at a really low budget.
Not without their challenges.
No, and, you kind of have to remember not to argue too much, but it's good, a mum with two kids is awesome, and you've got to be strong and carry your backpack because you've got everybody's stuff in it.
Do people think you were a bit mad, though?
Yes.
Friends back in Australia, family back in Australia?
Yeah, it's funny, it's mostly Australia and England thought I was mad, but in France they were like, "Ah, hello, come here, we'll feed you."
There you go. Yeah. So let's play out on another track from your beautiful album, the name of which is, in English, "In the Sea Also There Are Stars." Yeah, that's the name of the album.
That's the album name. Yeah.
How do you say it in French?
I've got the lyrics stuck in my head. Dans la mer aussi, il y a des étoiles.
Oh, beautiful. So what's the final track? Is it Salmaise.
So that's the little town in the valley I was adopted by a bourgogne.
Here we go. Let's take it away. Thanks so much for joining us on Life Matters.
No worries, thank you.
Great to hear this story.
Dear Robin Drew, in a town of more beauty than I have known, while the kids fall asleep, I look at you, the sun coming in through the window. I'm afraid to leave, I love you more every passing day. Just when I arrive, I go away. I'll dream of your balcony and red flowers. My heart is starting to tick again, but I say be quiet for now. Let pink sky speaks wonders unwritten, unknown. We walk the small streets from the castle of Salmes on top of the hill. A woman puts rabbits to sleep, a donkey and a well in the corner. I love this valley, silently beautiful. Children run laughing round trees. It echoes out of this small town. My heart is starting to dream again, but I say awaken.
just glorious. The song Salmes, you better say the album title for us, Melanie.
It's Don la mer aussi, il y a des étoiles.
Melanie Horsnell's fourth album just out, I think, yes. And we'll pop details on the Life Matters website. Great story about the adventures you can have in France and beyond. And in your own backyard sometimes too. Well, Michael Williams is coming up to talk about more adventures, a book written in part by one of my absolute favourite authors of all time. You have them all, it seems. Margaret Atwood, Michael.
We're spoiled for choice here, Natasha. I have to say I'm thrilled to see I'm not the only one who deliberately avoids speaking French on the radio.
Did you see that? You noticed that, didn't you?
That was seamless. Honestly, I'm always so self-conscious, so now I'm learning from you on on that one. Margaret Atwood's just written a new book. She churns them out at a decent rate, but this one's not coming out for 100 years. It's part of an art project happening just out of Oslo. It's extraordinary.
Good. Coming up straight after the news. It's 10 a.m. on RN.
I think my love of the carbohydrates end up winning out every time. White bread, potatoes and pizzas.
Many experts argue that surgery and drugs are the only way to beat Australia's public health epidemic of obesity. Surgery stats are confusing and weight loss drugs have had a precarious history. So what's a consumer to do? Plus, the future of surgery, it might mean not having to go under the knife at all. You can download this health report from the RN website.